and it's a good evening because it's the only evening. And this moment is happening simultaneously around the whole planet right now. And it's extending out past the solar system to the whole universe right at this moment. And we're existing in this moment in it at the same time. I mean, it's just extraordinary. What I'd like to talk about is how we become happier when we expand our sense of who we are. And who we are functions just in this moment, and this moment never stops. Like, it didn't begin, it didn't end. There's this infinite moment that is just a gift that we have all the time. And we are all just one thing. All of us here in this room are just one thing in this infinite moment. So there's no scarcity, there's no error, there's no fault. So what I just said then came to me when I woke up the other morning, and this is what happens when our practice deepens. We're practicing in our sleep. And isn't that just so cool? We practice in the Zendo, we practice when we say hello to people, we practice at work, and then we practice in our sleep. Never stop practicing. So what I'm wanting to talk about isn't going to be new at all. It's going to be, we've all heard this lots of times. But the idea of coming together like this is that it might strengthen our resolve to really pay attention to the teachings. You know, like, nothing new is going to be said, but it might strengthen each of our resolve to really want to wake up in this life. In Patrick's class on the Lotus Sutra the other week, he was quoting from Thich Nhat Hanh. I can't quite remember the context, but he was talking about sort of many lifetimes until one can wake up. And then Thich Nhat Hanh sort of said something like, "But you don't know how many hundreds of thousands of lifetimes you've already had. This might be the actual one." I like that. Okay. So this sense of who we are, if we can expand our sense of who we are. And actually, I asked Michael that question at the Shuso ceremony: how has your sense of self changed since you began practicing? And you said it's become bigger. And that's exactly right. It becomes bigger. So like with the seagull, it totally includes that seagull, not as an idea, but that really is me. Flying around up there, having whatever vision they're having of what they're seeing, that's me. Isn't that great? What fun we're having out there. like inside this body, inside here, is the oceans, mountains, the solar system, inside here. It's inside all of us. We just have to go like this and see it. And it also includes things like spiders and prison cells and corporate bankers. Anything that doesn't quite naturally come into your imagination as something that is a part of who you are includes all of those things. What's so critical to our understanding is how inclusive this sense of who we are is. It absolutely has to not exclude anything or anyone or any object. It has to include it, otherwise a kind of madness occurs. As soon as you exclude anything, a kind of madness occurs. And I think that madness occurs because we somehow intuit that that really is us, and we're trying to cut it off and say, no, it's not. We're trying to, either a person or an experience or a perception or an opinion, we're trying to cut it off and say, no, I don't like that thing. And then it creates a certain madness in us. So we have to practice including. So that's why I say, like, oh, spiders. I like spiders, but a lot of people don't really like spiders. So I go, oh, it includes spiders in there. And to be able to sit with that quite calmly. Go, oh, yeah, okay. Includes that. Yeah, absolutely. Includes the whole works, really does. This is the important thing about coming together and talking about it, is to try and help us start to really let that sink in, that it really does. Really does. Not just an interesting idea that you can say. You know, it's not something to say, it's something to feel. And we get infinite opportunities to practice it because we're always feeling aversion to something, not always. But often we are feeling little bits of subtle aversion, sometimes loud aversion, sometimes subtle aversion. And that's the opportunity to go like, oh, pull that inside me as well. In our koan class that meets on Fridays at 1 o'clock, we've talked about a couple of different koans recently, and I just thought I would say a few words about them. Case 36 from the Mamongkan. May you all have tattered books like this. Wutsu, meeting someone attained in the Tao. Wutsu said, when you meet someone attained in the Tao on the road, do not make your greetings with words or with silence. How will you make your greeting? We talked about this case for about 3 weeks. We did talk about it for 3 weeks. When you meet someone attained in the Tao on the road, do not make your greeting with words or with silence. How will you make your greeting? And it's interesting to notice what our habit of mind is around excluding things. We just have habits of mind. So one habit of mind in relation to this case is to possibly think, when I meet someone attained in the Tao, and we imagine someone sort of better than us, maybe. That's just what we kind of imagine. How will I greet them? What will I say to them? So this is an opportunity to go, oh, I wonder if someone attained in the Tao could be everyone. I wonder if it could be everything, inanimate as well as animate. What would it be like if we saw everything as someone attained in the Tao? You know? And even if they're doing something that we think is harmful, it doesn't mean we can't also hold that they're someone attained in the Tao. They just don't know it right now. But what if we greeted them within ourselves that way? Because we're attained in the Tao too. Because we're all attained in the Tao. And we just have so many opportunities for greeting people. You know, we just are greeting people constantly at work and walking down the street and in stores and at the Zendo, out on the porch, patio. And when we really greet them with a sense of no gap between us, with a sense of connection between us, that we're actually the same thing, when we greet people that way, then we are greeting, we're greeting without words or without silence. Then we're just pure greeting. There's no concepts about whether we're doing it one way or another way. We're just going, hey, hi there. Laurie and I just finished making a little altar at the curbside down at the corner of 119. And I get times during the day where I get to sit on the porch and watch what happens when people walk past. And it's just fantastic. People are walking along and then they look at it and they just stop. Maybe for 10 seconds. They just stop. And people have been putting pennies. There's quite a few pennies there. And a couple of dimes. But they just stop. And I feel like for that moment, they're just greeting the present. For that moment, they just look at that little Buddha that's there and have some kind of thought, probably something about peace or kindness, just some little thought like that, and they just must look at it, and then they keep going. But they've just greeted the moment there. So I'm really happy that we did that. So many thanks to the different people who helped in different ways to get that altar out there. And then the case that we are currently studying in the group on Friday is Zhao Zhou, the oak tree in the courtyard. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? And Zhao Zhou said, the oak tree in the courtyard. And this is a case that gives us another interesting way to look at habits of mind. So the case is, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? Which is a sentence that gets used a lot, and you can just sort of say, like, what's the point? What's the point of it all? Why are we doing this? This is just a formalized way of asking, like, why did Buddhism bother traveling across from India to China? Why do we bother doing it here? It's just that sort of a question. And Zhao Zhou says, the oak tree in the courtyard. And he was probably pointing. They were probably sitting somewhere, and he probably just pointed to the nearest tree and said, the oak tree in the courtyard. So that habit of our mind could be to go like, oh yeah, I get that. That's pretty straightforward. You know, what's Buddha? It's just whatever. It's this cup of water. I get it. Okay, I get that case. Let's move on to the next case. But the thing is that we don't really get this. We get it sometimes, but we don't get it 24 hours a day. And that's what the practice is about, trying to increase the amount of time in which we really get that this present moment is this extraordinary, infinite thing that we're in. And we're always in it anyway, but in our minds we tend to get caught in our thoughts and we're thinking about the past or the future and we're being we've got a diffused awareness of the present. We don't have a sharp awareness of the present. So the case continues a little bit, and I love it when monks persist. So the monk asked Zhao Zhou, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? And Zhao Zhou says, the oak tree in the courtyard. And then the monk says, please don't teach me with reference to outside things. And I was thinking here, you could change that outside things to objects, because often in talks teachers will say, this book, or these glasses. And sometimes I think people can feel a little frustrated about, okay, I get it about the glasses and I get it about the book, but what about something more complicated than that? So the monk might have been feeling a bit like that, like I've heard this reference to objects as a way to explain the Dharma. So he says, don't teach me with reference to outside things, to other stuff. I want to know about it close in somehow. And Jiajo says, I don't teach with reference to outside things. And the monk says, well, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And Jiajo says, the oak tree in the courtyard. So Jiajo's really encouraging the monk to be connected with everything and not to discriminate between what's a more interesting thing to be connected with and what's a less interesting thing to be connected with. You know, if we're just observant of anything that's happening, that's arising in this present moment, it's just amazing. When we're really attentive to it, it's just always amazing. The floorboards are just amazing. I often imagine if I had been in solitary confinement for 20 years, what would it be like if I was released? I have been in solitary confinement, of course. There's parts of me are in solitary confinement right now. Parts of us are in solitary confinement right now, all around the world, particularly in the United States. What would it be like for those eyes to suddenly see things, you know? And that's how we should be functioning all the time. Just seeing with the constant appreciation, not with glazed eyes, not with like seen that before, done that before, same old thing. Because all of this is expanding. It's not expanding who we are. We are these things. It's expanding our awareness that we are all these things. And that just makes us happy. Just makes us happy. It's so abundant. And it doesn't have to exclude all the difficult things. It still makes us happy, even though it includes all the pain and suffering. And it's appropriate, I think, to have a little sort of well of sadness that we carry all the time. I think it's appropriate to have that. In Sesshin, we chant the Genjo Koan, and when we chant it, we have to do it fast. And sometimes I find that hard because I see a line and I want to contemplate the line, but if I contemplate the line, I'll lose my place. So I I have to keep talking, to keep going. So I just would like to read a couple of the lines more slowly, because we don't get to do that during session. So as we practice, as many of us are doing, expanding our sense of who we are, then these lines from Dogen really, really become alive. They're not just an idea. They start to just, you feel it to be true. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. And I often think you can turn that the other way around as well. To be actualized by myriad things, we forget the self. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs, but Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. This idea about far away, that nothing's far away, and gets a very useful thought just to keep reminding ourselves, nothing's far away. War somewhere else is not far away. injustice somewhere else is not far away. Happiness that's occurring, like a big wedding or some big feast, it's not far away. But this forgetting the self, when we're actualized by myriad things, we forget the self. That sometimes I think can sound a little bit scary to people, as if that we'll lose our personality or lose our history. But actually, what we lose is just the delusions we have about ourselves. So we actually just lose the painful stuff. We do lose our neuroses. Probably not 100%. But we do lose a lot of our neuroses. We lose a lot of our obsession about ourselves, because when you expand your definition of who you are, then the fine details of this particular manifestation, this sort of nirvana manifestation, the particulars of that just don't become so compelling. They're just not so compelling. When you include the rest of the world in your definition of who you are, then the particulars of your own troubles are seen within the light of a much bigger picture, and so they just don't have as much kind of bite to them. So we do lose that. We do lose part of those stories about ourselves. Feelings of being wronged and feelings of being inferior. And we gain so much. We just gain so much. So when we hear these words of forgetting the self, and if this happens to you, that you feel a little worried about that, you don't like the idea of losing yourself, it's only the bad bits that you lose. Don't lose the good bits. Because the good bits are the non-delusion piece. They're actually the collective reality. So you don't lose that. You don't lose this present moment. You just lose your thoughts about who you are. You lose a little bit of that. And that's very nice to let go of. I'm sure the historical Buddha had a personality of some sort. We don't really know what it is because it's too far away, and they didn't have YouTube then, so we can't watch. But I'm sure he had a personality, and so all of us keep our personalities, and then we include everyone else's personalities as well, and we become one great big, huge personality. In our Monday morning study group, we're studying Nagarjuna, the son of wisdom. Just before I read this bit, when we talk about real or not real, I like the way Nagarjuna uses the term mere appearance, that we're mere appearances. What is that? It's a dove. We have them in Australia, so whenever I hear one here, I get this like, oh.
Morning dove.
Morning dove. Is it M-O-R-N morning or M-O-U-R-N morning?
I think it's O-U.
Oh, you? Morning, Dad.
Oh, you, yeah.
So, yeah. So the way I tend to... I don't think I'm very philosophically minded, so this is the way how I make sense of difficult Buddhist ideas. I function as if everything is real, in a practical sense, and that way I'm respectful and I'm attentive, I'm caring, I'm joyful, because I take it seriously. This is this beautiful thing. I take it seriously. And at the same time, I function as if it's all a dream. That it's just a mere appearance. That when there's no distinction between anything, and then there's one thing, you can't really even have one thing, because then there's got to be some outside edge to it for it to be one. So it's all a dream. And when I carry that at the same time, then I'm much less attached to any sort of outcomes. I just function with this respect and care, and then just don't be attached to outcomes, because it's all a dream. So if that's a helpful heuristic for you, you can take that one on too. It's real and it's a dream at the same time. So I'll just read some Nagarjuna. If we can see that things are not truly real, that they are mere appearances, whose true nature is beyond all concepts of what it might be, then our experience of both good and bad events in life will be open, spacious, and relaxed. When something good happens, we will be able to enjoy it in a relaxed way, free of clinging to it, and free of the fear of it departing. Very important point. When something bad happens, if we recognize its true nature, we will be relaxed within it, and our minds will be undisturbed. In short, realizing the true nature of reality brings inner peace, genuine happiness and ease that outer conditions cannot disturb. And I'm certainly finding as time goes on that outer conditions don't have nearly as much impact on my general state of mind. And it's very nice. Because there's, in terms of conditions, there's infinite amount of different conditions happening all over the place, all the time. So, I mean, if you just kind of gather them all up, it'd probably just be consistent all the time. So if I perceive myself to be everything, all the conditions that are happening to everything, humans, animals, objects, in all directions infinitely, then how in the world could I have kind of, you know, moods going up and down based on conditions? It wouldn't really make any sense. And the conditions of my own personal life just don't become nearly as important. Still have to attend to them, this idea of things being real, so you attend to them. But they're a dream as well. And they're tiny in the pool of everybody, because I'm all these things, so the little particulars of little bother, a little problem. It's just that, you just do what you have to do. Oh, and actually, I thought that I find very helpful is if I'm worrying about whether, say, I'm going to succeed at something, to be able to carry in my mind, I'm already succeeding all over the place. I'm already failing all over the place. I've already been abandoned all over the place. I've already been loved. I've already been defamed. I've already been misunderstood. I've already been praised. I am already, this is happening to me all the time right now. I'm already being praised. I'm already being damned. So then whatever happens to this particular manifestation isn't such a big deal. Just want it to be beneficial as much as possible. Okay. So another part of the Genjo Koan which we read fast and don't get time to go slowly with, so I want to go slowly with it right now, is near the end, Zen Master Bao Qi of Mount Mayu was fanning himself. Everybody probably knows this case here. It's one of my favorite cases. A monk approached him and said, "Master, the nature of wind is permanent and there is no place it does not reach. Why then do you fan yourself?" "Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent," Bao Qi replied, "you do not understand the meaning of it reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of it reaching everywhere?" asked the monk again. The master just kept fanning himself. "If you say that you do not need to fan yourself because the nature of wind is permanent and you can have wind without fanning, you will understand neither permanence nor the nature of wind." So I like this case because it's so ordinary. There's a grand idea of what wind might be. There's a grand idea of what oneness might be, or emptiness. And then there's just the mere simple fact of our reality right now, in this room, in this moment, fanning. Don't have to worry about the concept. I've written here that the miracle of wind becomes apparent when we fan ourselves. The miracle of awareness becomes apparent when we just see something. California poppy, floorboards. The miracle of this awareness that never dies, infinite, eternal awareness. Oh no, I did have a few more things. To deepen our awareness of these basic teachings, we can't just be hopeful that it'll just happen by coming here on a Wednesday evening or something. We have to really practice. And we have to believe that we are capable of really understanding our largesse, that we are capable of understanding how big we are. It's really important to have faith that we can do this, that we can do this in this lifetime. But it does take a sort of work, a kind of effort. We talk about effortless effort quite often. It does take some kind of effort, and the kinds of effort that we can gently apply is coming here to do zazen, contemplating. And the sutras are great, because if you can memorize a few lines, then that's what you can contemplate while you're driving. That's what you can contemplate while you're doing the dishes. So memorizing just fragments of the sutras can be very, very beneficial. Or memorizing koans, which are kind of good too, because they're so short. You can just memorize a very brief dialogue and then just carry it around with you. We are actually having an introduction to koans on Saturday morning from 9:30 to 12. So if you're interested, no experience necessary. Please sign up out there, or just turn up, but sign up if you remember. And, you know, just that you come is important. If you can afford to pay the fee, then that's great. But just yourself is enough, as we have written on our donation box there. Just yourself is magnificent. The other ways is we have got 5 teachers in this Sangha, and you can meet with them and have Dokusan with them. You can meet with them one-on-one and talk about your practice with them. And that's an enormous resource that we have here. So please don't be shy to utilize that, to meet with them. You just talk to them whenever you see them and ask if you can, and talk about your practice with them. And it can be incredibly helpful. Sometimes we can get a little bit caught in the privacy of our own minds. And to just actually articulate face to face, eye to eye with someone who you respect, it's extraordinarily good for practice. You can just something will be said that will just resonate, and then you'll just carry that with you, and it might stay with you for years. Just the way a little piece of dialogue occurred. Just the way the eye contact occurred. You know, so we don't sort of have a big notice saying that that's available, but it is available, so don't hesitate to utilize it. And the other thing you can do, which people don't like to hear this so much, is you can discard some of your bad habits. You can ask yourself, is this particular habit likely to lead to enlightenment? Probably not. Do I want to try letting it go? No. Will I? Maybe tomorrow. Maybe next week. So you might want to consider some of your habits and whether they encourage kind of clinging, grasping energy, or whether they encourage aversion, avoidance energy. Two sides of the same coin. So that usually is pretty important to start chipping away at those habits that actually keep us away from a full engagement with the present. Okay. Any questions or comments?
Been thinking about this, when we talk about going inward or looking inward, what does inward really mean? Does it mean inside the body or inside the mind?
Yeah.
When we're telling we're going in, what are we really going towards?
Yeah. Well, for me, I think that's when I do this sort of like opening up and seeing the whole universe inside my body, going in or going deep. That's what that is for me. So it's really not distinguishable between out or in. It's just that we use a word in our language. We just use words. So people often talk about going deeper, and I think when we say going deeper or going inward, in a way I think we're saying away from actually getting caught up in thinking things are actually separate from us, that there really is this book and there's me and there's you, and that we're actually separate things. I think going inward or going deeper means to sort of just suspend that delusion, this is a delusion, suspend that delusion and contemplate something more unified and quiet. But for me, I have this real sense of like all the oceans are right in there. So when someone says, go inward, cool, that sounds great. Go into this vast ocean. Is that helpful?
I'm still looking for more answers, but yeah, that's definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Richard.
Just to follow up on that, I like your answer. I think it's probably part of the answer. I think there's two protective self that isn't habituated, watching what comes up in our body when we get angry and when we're upset and when we're reactive and what our habits are, and noticing those things so that we can start to have a relationship with them that might enable us to transform. Just more on the same question of going inward. So it's a multiplicity.
Yeah, thank you. That's very well put. Thank you.
I notice when you talk about going inward, you're going into a very big place. It's almost more like you're going, when you're going inward, you're going out, or you're going inward, but when you go inward, your arms widen.
Yeah.
I get so much out of that. When you go inward, there's this enormous, endless quality to it. It's wonderful to see that. I mean, I take that with me because that's beyond words. You're going inward is such a huge place. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Oh, sorry, I didn't see you there.
So when you spoke about contemplating sutras or koans during your daily activity, how do you balance that between being present for that activity and contemplating, maybe? Because to me that seems, like, for me personally, difficult. I don't know. Maybe it isn't.
Well, our minds have got this amazing capacity to think a huge amount in a small amount of time. I remember one time I thought I'll just see if I could track what I think over about 30 seconds while I was driving my car. And I couldn't keep up with the amount of thoughts that I was able to have, like just noticing different things. So our minds are going to think a lot of things. But while we're doing some, either just relaxing on the porch where we're not doing anything in particular, but letting our eyes just settle on whatever's in front of us, we can be, our mind will want to do something. So while we're doing something that doesn't require a lot of focused attention, but we're just there, like maybe at a bus stop, something, then our mind will just do something. So we can let it do something like think about what we're going to cook or something like that, or what we should have said to someone, or we can take up that part of the mind that's going to think anyway, take it up with contemplation. And while we're contemplating, we're present to the fact that we're doing it. So it's not like an absent-minded contemplating. I don't know, well, you probably can absent-mindedly contemplate. I think I do that. But I also intentionally contemplate. So it's like when, that's what I use examples of, like doing the dishes or being at traffic lights or in the line at the grocery store. There are times when there's sort of spare mental room because you don't need a lot of focused attention to be there. I mean, you could just fully attend to the objects, like in the grocery line. I do that a lot and it's so interesting. Different types of gum, all the different flavours, some have got sugar, some don't. I mean, it's just fascinating looking at all the stuff, the people, the things that people take out of their shopping carts and just stick there. So it's all the chewing gum and then there's like a pepperoni or something. You're like, what? That seems like a strange combination of things, you know. So this is infinitely interesting wherever you are. It's always interesting. But I do think could at the same time just carry some aspect of the teachings, and we're aware that we're doing it. So it's not like we're being distracted from the present, because part of the present at that time is contemplating one of the teachings, and we are intentionally doing that with awareness that we're doing it. Is that helpful? Okay. One more question or comment?
Yeah, as you were just talking, I was thinking, you know, if you memorize some of the sutras as you're suggesting, There's another way sometimes that in an interaction it will just naturally arise as kind of a response, an interior response to an interaction.
Yeah.
So that's another, I don't know if that you would consider that contemplation, but maybe a fruit of the practice of memorizing is to have these sort of wisdom teachings that are kind of floating around somewhere in the background, and then they are invited forward by something that happens.
Yeah, I think it just starts to become natural. It actually becomes the default of our thinking. I think over time, it's actually our default is to be contemplating the Dhamma. I mean, that's just such a wonderful thing. How much better is that, to have that as your default, that rather than the, you know, we can all think of millions of examples of what else it could be.
Quick example of that I love is, you know, from one of our koans is that so, you know, with the baby in the and that's one that has really made a difference in my life.
Right.
To just carry that, you know.
Yeah.
As opposed to taking something personally or having to have a response, just have that nonsense. So,
yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
It's such a world of useful practice.
Yeah. Our morning sits at 5:45, Monday to Friday. We chant a different sutra each morning. We do the Heart Sutra, and we do one other sutra. So it's great to come here early in the mornings, just every now and then, if you're not a regular person, but every now and then, and just let the words sort of wash over you and through you, and you might find a phrase that you just grab and really like, just like what Richard's describing, and then it just stays with you.
At 5:45 p.m. too, we chant.
And 5:45 p.m.
So if you can't quite make it at 5:45 a.m.,
we
also do it in the
And it's the different sutras each evening too. Okay, so there you go. Two opportunities to, and then the midday sit just to sit quiet. Michael.
And all of our sutras are at szzz.org.
Woo!
All right, so thank you very much. And let's see, dedicate the merit of the giving and receiving of the teachings together. I dedicate it to us across the whole planet, which is, we are all it together. Beings on